This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world. Well, today we begin our first interview about conspiracies. As you Dreamlanders know, some of you, I have said that I would start a series about this, and we will be dipping into this from time to time over the next few months. But we're going to begin in a very strange way. Well, naturally, I mean, this is Dreamland, right? What do you expect? I was wondering the other night, what should I start with? And I watch every night, late at night, before I do my nightly meditation at 11, I usually watch an old television show called What's My Line? And I was watching What's My Line, and on it there are a number of panelists, including a reporter, Dorothy Kilgallen. Now, I know a little bit about her. I knew she died rather mysteriously after interviewing Jack Ruby after the Kennedy assassination. That's all I knew. And to my amazement, after the show was over, there suddenly popped up an interview with a man called Mark Shaw, a YouTube interview. And I thought, what can this be? And it was, to my amazement, it was about Dorothy Kilgallen. And so I thought, well, I'm being asked to start here, clearly. And it gets more amazing. And when you hear Mark, you're going to find out just why. Mark has been a best-selling author for many years. His first book about Dorothy was The Reporter Who Knew Too Much. He then followed it up with Denial of Justice. And we're going to get very deeply into Dorothy Kilgallen on this Dreamland and what happened to this woman. Mark, I would like you to start by telling us how you came to Dorothy Kilgallen.
Good. Well, we share this belief. I think we both have open minds. And so, you know, we'll watch carefully when things sift through our lives. And I never intended to write about Dorothy. I didn't know that much about her. You knew more than I did. I knew that she was on What's My Line, and that was pretty much it. But I started this whole situation with being interested in writing a biography of a famous lawyer in San Francisco named Melvin Belli. And for those that don't know, Belli was a legend in his own time and in his own mind in many ways. He was a personal injury lawyer for the most part, tort lawyer, who sued pharmaceutical companies and others in behalf of injured clients and got multi-million dollar verdicts. He was the first one to do that. But he also had a list of clients that was impressive: the Rolling Stones, Tammy Faye Baker, Muhammad Ali, Errol Flynn, all of those people. And I was fortunate enough in the 1980s, when I was practicing a little law in San Francisco, to have an office in his building down on Montgomery Street. And for those who visited during that time in the 80s, it was like a museum. And he purposely had gotten his window right near the street and was on the Gray Line bus tour and all of that. And people could look in there and see this skeleton that he used in the courtroom and all of this amazing material that he'd brought back from the Far East and all of that. So when Belli died, I knew him very well. In fact, in the 80s, he took me to the Major League Baseball All-Star Game in his Rolls-Royce convertible. He was going through the sixth of his six marriages.
Oh, my.
He's a bigger-than-life character, and I got to know him very well. So when he died in 1996, I had written a number of biographies, and I wanted to write a biography about Belli. And the most interesting thing was that he had written two autobiographies. But when I read them, I noticed that they conflicted. So his own two books about himself conflicted, and so I began my research and interviewed a lot of colleagues, some of whom I knew from being in the building and all that, interviewed his sixth wife, Nancy, and all of them, and ended up writing a book called Melvin Belli, King of the Courtroom. So I want to go just skip ahead a little bit, because what concerned me at that particular point is I found out more about Belli's allegiance to the mafia. He was kind of a mafia wannabe. He loved to hang out in Las Vegas with those guys and for people to think that he was involved in the mafia. But he did have one client who was definitely in the mafia, and that was Mickey Cohen. And so I got to wondering about his representation. The Bell I represented, many people will remember, Jack Ruby, who shot Lee Harvey Oswald. So I got to wondering about connections between Bell I and Cohen and how Bell I became Ruby's lawyer and all of that. And that led me to Joe Kennedy, and I wrote a second book called The Poison Patriarch about Joe Kennedy and the 1960 election and the fact that there were some shady things going on there with getting help from some of the mobsters to win Illinois and West Virginia so JFK would win the White House, and that Joe had made a promise to leave those guys alone if they helped. And so that led me into the arena of the JFK assassination. Once I completed that book and really decided that that was it, there was one quote, and I'm just like you, I think, that sometimes there's something that's said to you and you just can't get it out of your mind. While I was interviewing a friend of Bell I's in San Diego, a doctor, we started talking about Bell I and the JFK assassination. He was giving me some interesting things, but then he said, well, you know, Bell I knew Dorothy Kilgallen. And I said, well, you know, he was on What's My Line. He said, no, Mark, you don't know anything about her. Yes, she was the star panelist on that show, but she also was syndicated to 200 newspapers across the country back when people actually read newspapers, the New York Journal American. She had a radio show with her husband every day in New York, listened to by a million people, and she covered many of the major trials of the 20th century. Dr. Sam Shepard, which became the film The Fugitive with Harrison Ford, the Lindbergh baby kidnapping case, and the Jack Ruby case. And I said, is that right? And he said, yeah, you know, it was really strange, Mark. When Dorothy Kilgallen mysteriously died in 1965, Bell I said to me, Mel said to me, well, they've killed Dorothy. Now they'll go after Jack Ruby. They've killed Dorothy. Now they'll go after Jack Ruby. Well, I couldn't get that quote out of my mind. And that was the trigger point to my really looking into and investigating Dorothy and finding out more about her, and then, of course, her mysterious death.
Free Dreamlanders will be right back. Subscribers will keep on keeping on.
1968, Glynis MacKay is a desperate woman. She's been told she's dying of cancer. She can no longer speak. She receives a psychic communication from aliens that she has been in touch with for years. Listen to her talk about what happened.
I went into this huge room, and there were many other people sitting and some lying on couches that had come there for healing. And then he said to me, you understand who sent you here to me? And I'm thinking, what does he mean? And then he said, you've been having communication for many, many years from who you call UFOs. And I thought, my God, how does he know this? And I'm trying to sort of push back on the chair, looking a bit shocked probably. And he said to me, when you leave here at 12:10 today, there are two craft over the house and you will see them.
And she and her mother-in-law both saw a UFO hanging over their house. Subsequently, Glynis's cancer disappeared, and she went on to become one of the world's most extraordinary mediums. UnknownCountry.com and Dreamland are among the very few places Glynis has interviewed. She became close friends with Ann Streber and with myself, and in our own personal lives revealed some extraordinary experiences. I had a contact with a dead friend so incredible with Glynis that it convinced me that there must be something more. There almost has to be. In fact, many things have taken me in that direction, but this was just shocking. In any case, you can hear all of this as a subscriber to UnknownCountry.com by going to our vast archive. It's so simple to search. Just look at the subject cloud on the left side after you enter the subscriber area, and you'll find so much there. Go to unknowncountry.com right now and subscribe. It's an immensely valuable and deeply empowering archive, and the site needs your support.
We're talking to Mark Shaw. His website, markshawbooks.com, where you can see the output of a truly extraordinary career. It goes back a while. He's like me in that respect. But not only has he written about Melvin Belli and JFK, and he has written about, of course, Dorothy Kilgallen. There's Miscarriage of Justice, the Jonathan Pollard story, mm-hmm. Courage in the Face of Evil, based on a true story about the Holocaust, Beneath the Mask of Holiness, Thomas Merton and the Forbidden Love Affair that Set Him Free. What a fascinating, fascinating body of work. So then we sort of jumped in at the beginning of the show, and I didn't really even say, welcome to Dreamland, and this is his first shot at Dreamland, and I'm so glad that you're here. Now, in the interview you did on YouTube, you told a somewhat different story about how you came to Dorothy. It's not in contradiction to what you just told us, but it's a add that to it, will you?
Well, it's in addition to, because
right, exactly.
Yeah, because you know, we both have open minds with regard to the paranormal, and
oh yes,
and you know, believing that there are times when you know, things are going to happen that other people would think were very strange and all of that. But not for me. I've always felt like that I've been connected in some ways to those who have left us. And so I was going to add to the Belli situation is that when I heard that quote, they've killed Dorothy, now they're going to go after Jack Ruby, I suddenly just felt an urge, a feeling, whatever you want to call it, that Dorothy Kilgallen had brought this information along, and that she wanted me to look into her life and times and her death. And I was sure of that right away when I started to do that, because nobody else had. When she died in 1965, and we'll get into her mysterious death, she basically disappeared from the face of the earth, this amazing, inspiring woman, a reporter of integrity, had disappeared after she was after she died, and they said it was an accidental overdose of barbiturates and alcohol. She disappeared from the face of the earth. And so I began to get this feeling about Dorothy, and I don't know if you ever do this, but I found a photograph of her. I put it up on the wall near my writing table, and I can only tell you that ever since that happened, which was probably about 2013, maybe 6-7 years ago, Dorothy has been my guiding light. Both with The Reporter Who knew Too Much, Denial of Justice, and a new book, Collateral Damage. It'll come out next year. She's just there for me. And many times I felt like I didn't have a book, or I didn't have enough material, or whatever. And she does it in several ways. Sometimes in the middle of the night, that's when I get my best ideas. I'll wake up, and I feel like Dorothy is giving me information. I write it down quickly on little notepads that I have. She'll have, I believe, in many ways, readers of my books, or people have listened to, you know, there's almost 2 million views of my presentations and interviews up on YouTube. She'll have people watch those, maybe like you,
exactly,
and decide that you should talk to me and give me information and all of that. And we don't know what will happen with this show, because many of your listeners, they may have known something about Dorothy or her death or whatever, and I will hear from them. I always give out my website. I answer every single email I get. And so, long story short, Dorothy has just been there for me, and she continues to be. And I'm just so fortunate because, as you may know, she really was the most credible reporter to have ever covered the Jack Ruby trial, because unlike me and all the other so-called experts who've written about it, we weren't there. But Dorothy was in the front row at the Jack Ruby trial and interviewed Ruby, as you say. And so I'm just honored that I think she chose me to tell her story, and I've been honored to do so.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I was starting this, and I had no idea where it would lead. And mm-hmm. What happened was, you know, YouTube has an algorithm, and if you watch What's My Line, you get all kinds of other episodes of What's My Line, but you don't get this. It's in all the year I've been watching What's My Line long before, when it was on the Game Show channel. Ann and I, my wife and I, used to watch it, so I've been watching it
really?
For 10 years. Yeah. I loved it when I was a kid. It was mm-hmm. my favorite TV show.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And so it's very relaxing to watch it in the evening.
Yeah.
But that came up out of nowhere. It doesn't, it's not, there's nothing in YouTube that would do it. So I've found it quite interesting and mysterious. But now let's go on to, you know, there's one question I want to, I'll move through this in a more orderly manner in a minute. But there's one question that I want to get to first, and that is that question of the manuscript that Dorothy had written. And listeners, let Mark tell you first, there was a finished manuscript, or nearly finished, wasn't there, right before she died?
Well, that's a bit of conjecture, and I'm very careful not to speculate. I only use primary sources. I'm very careful with this, but I think we can put things together. We can just give a bit of a journey here for Dorothy. The reason that she was so interested in the JFK assassination is because she knew him personally, not only through seeing him as a senator in the New York watering holes where he was out, sometimes with Jackie, sometimes not.
Right.
But also, at one point, he came to her home, played charades there, and so, you know, she was in his column, or he was in her column and all of that, but she took one day her son, you may have read that in Denial of Justice, she took her son to the White House. Pierre Salinger set up a time when JFK could be in the library, and she brought little Carrie in with her. He was in the third grade, and JFK just made a big fuss over him. He loved children, and that's one of the things I'm going to present more about him in the new book, but he made a big fuss over Carrie. He gave him a PT-109 pin. He made a fuss over the letters that the little boy had brought from his third grade class. And so when he died, Dorothy took it personally. And right away, you know, Dorothy was just such a great investigative reporter. But to her, she covered a lot of criminal trials in New York City, and then, of course, Lindbergh and Shepard and all those cases. But she always was had a great curiosity. And she couldn't figure out exactly to begin with why JFK was killed and why this Oswald guy was supposedly the only one. And then when Jack Ruby shot Oswald, well, she just took the first flight to Dallas because she didn't buy that. And she began these columns, and you can read them, on the website, the DorothyKilgallenStory.org, or in my books, and you'll see that 6 days after JFK died, she wrote a column, the Oswald file must not close. And she was really the only one who was going in that direction, because J. Edgar Hoover was shouting, Oswald alone, Oswald alone, Oswald alone. And Dorothy didn't buy all that. So she wrote all these columns and got herself kind of in trouble with Hoover. I have some columns where we found him writing on her columns in his own hand, wrong, 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 this is all wrong. So he was watching her very carefully in terms of what she was doing. So the other thing that she did to infuriate him and everyone else was that she published before the release date his testimony at the Warren Commission on the front pages of the Journal American. And it was an exclusive like none other at the time. And so that didn't didn't give Hoover much pleasure for sure. So then what does Dorothy do? Well, she keeps a file there. She interviews Ruby twice, one time for about 8 minutes, the other for a little more. And whatever he tells her, and we have Joe Tannehill, who was Melvin Belli's co-counsel. There's an interview, taped interview with him on the DorothyKilgallenStory.org, where you can see how he set up the interviews for Dorothy and the railing behind the defense counsel table. She sat there with him, and then she wrote a column about that, but she didn't divulge exactly what he said. She just said when she left the lunchroom that day that she had a completely different view of the assassination. So what does she do then? She takes this file with her, and she heads for New Orleans. And I had shown in The Poison Patriarch that the most logical motive for assassinating JFK, based on motive and everything, came from Joe Kennedy's double cross of the mafia who helped them win the election, and that the main person that Bobby Kennedy went after he was forced by he was appointed to Attorney General by JFK after Joe Kennedy ordered JFK to do so, was to deport Marcello, Carlos Marcello, the New Orleans Don, whose territory stretched to Dallas, and also charged him with racketeering and all of that. So as 1963 came along, Marcello's back was against the wall. And from Bill Alexander, the prosecutor of the Ruby case, and others, I finally came up with what I believe Dorothy knew at the time, that what you needed to do was not look at why JFK was assassinated, but why Bobby Kennedy was not, because he had many, many more enemies than JFK did at the time. Why Bobby Kennedy was not assassinated instead of why JFK was. So what did she do with that theory in mind? She went to New Orleans, and she had this mysterious trip with her hairdresser, Mark Sinclair, and his videotaped interview is up on the same website that I mentioned before. And she called him from the hotel and said, hey, you go back to New York City, don't tell anyone you're here, and don't ask any questions. And so he did. And then she went back to New York, and she made a big mistake. And that was that she was writing a book for Random House, and this is the manuscript you're talking about. We don't know exactly how far along she was with it, but she was telling everybody, unfortunately. She was too much of a blabbermouth. I'm going to break this case wide open.
Yeah.
If the wrong people knew what I know about the JFK assassination, would cost me my life. I'm afraid for my life and my family. I'm getting a gun, but I'm going to crack this wide open. And so what she kept doing then at that point in this studio, writing studio she had in the top of her townhouse, was work on the manuscript. Now, what we do know is that the manuscript was in some sort of fashion, because the night she died, the night before she died, well, in the night she died or in the next morning early she died, just prior to her last What's My Line show, and people can go watch that on YouTube, you'll see Dorothy is exuberant, she's sharp, she has no issues with her speech, slurring, nothing, no alcohol, no drugs, no nothing. She showed part of the manuscript to Bennett Cerf because, people may remember, he was the founder of Random House, and he was her editor. And so we know that that manuscript existed. Unfortunately, when we get through talking about how she died, that file that had some of the manuscript, notes about Ruby's trial, and her interview with him and all of that, that file disappeared and has yet to be found to this day.
Is there any truth to the story that floats around that it was given to a friend and the friend died a few days later?
This was Florence Pritchett, I think her name is.
Yes.
I've heard that from so many different people, and I will tell you, I've researched it thoroughly. The only two people that Dorothy, and I have found no substantiation for it, the only two people that Dorothy shared anything with were Mark Lane, okay? Mark Lane, the author, Rush to Judgment, and, who had looked into the assassination as well, and people can read about what he thought at that time, and a gentleman named Ron Pataki, who was a journalist from Columbus, Ohio, that Kilgallen was having a love affair with at the time.
And we will be talking
kind of estranged, right?
Much more about him in a few minutes.
Right.
Go ahead.
And so those were the only two people that I have been able to prove that she ever shared any part of either what Ruby told her or any parts of the manuscript.
Did Florence actually die shortly after?
Well, that's the crazy thing. Yes, she did. And so people have connected that, and they rightfully can do so. I mean, I respect every single thing anybody comes up with, theories,
yeah,
and so on and so forth, what it is. But at one point, I do have in the new book, I found a column that Florence Pritchett had written prior to Dorothy's death, substituting for Dorothy as the columnist when Dorothy was away. And so there's a photograph of her in there. Also, her husband, I think his last name was Smith, was a very close friend of JFK's. I have a photograph that very few people have ever seen. It's amazing so many people have said that. It's JFK, and his shirt is off, and he has like a girdle on across his back because, you know, he had the terrible back problems.
Right.
And he's standing there with Florence Pritchett's husband, whose name I say, last name was Smith. And so there's all those connections there, and they lead you to believe that Dorothy would have confided in somebody like Florence Pritchett, but as I say, to this day, I can't prove that.
Free Dreamlanders, we're going to take another brief break here. Subscribers, we'll keep right on keeping on.
Notice anything unusual about Unknown Country? When you land on the site, you don't see ads about things you've bought or things some data miner thinks you might like. Why not? Because when you come to Unknown Country, your visit is private. We don't use data miners. We don't report to them. When you come here, we leave you alone, which is as it should be everywhere. Another thing you don't see are video ads that start when you least expect it, pop-ups that interfere with your reading, clutter that distracts you. What do you see? Stories that go in depth, that see beyond where the general media will take you, but don't seek to confuse you with sensation and hoaxes. Plus, a gigantic news archive that's easily searchable with our powerful search engine and entirely free. Unknown Country, the internet as it ought to be, the truth that others will not tell you. Want to keep it coming? Join us today. Click on the subscribe tab on the masthead and get started. Unknown Country needs you, and you need us.
We're talking to Mark Shaw. Mark, of course, is one of the true professionals in the field of, I would say, conspiracy theory. Just although that's a kind of a not quite the right way to.
How about investigating reporting?
Investigative reporter. Yeah. Okay. You know, we're having so much trouble right now in our world with these crazy conspiracy theories. And I think that my personal belief, I don't want to get into this, I just want to pass be brief, is that someone is using social engineering tools to promote a lot of obviously completely insane theories, which have the result of throwing out the baby with the bathwater. And serious researchers like you end up being dropped into the same bucket. And it's a technique I know well, having been living in the UFO community as long as I have. And I just think it's being done on a massive scale now, and I really worry about that. In any case, back to Mark. Mark's website is markshawbooks.com. It's a great site, and you can learn about all of his books and his work there, and also contact him. If you've got anything to add to this, please contact Mark through his website. It's not hard to do. That's why he's here. I contacted him through his website, and guess what? It works.
Yeah, and let me speak to that again about the fact that for whatever reason, and I believe it was meant to be that you got in touch with me. Again, the reason I say if anybody out there knows anything, because, again, Dorothy, and I just got a little chill sometimes when I say these things, but Dorothy guided me to what I believe are the most important documents about the JFK assassination in history. There's this gentleman down in Fresno, California. Lawyer there, Greg Mullinex, and one day he called me and he said, "Mark, I've just read The Reporter Who Knew Too Much and Denial of The Reporter Who Knew Too Much. That's what was out at the time, and I bought it at 5 and read it by 10, and I want you to know that I have a gift for you." And I said, "What's that?" He said, "Well, I have a copy of the Jack Ruby trial transcripts." And I thought, "Duh! Why in the world didn't I ever think of looking for those things?" And sure, there were transcripts. I should have done that a long time ago. But after I got over that embarrassment, he said, "I'm going to send them to you." Well, he did. And he said also to me, "You know, I just had the feeling that I was supposed to find these and get them to you. And I know that you said in The Reporter Who Knew Too Much that Dorothy seems to influence you. I'm just wondering if she influenced me." I said, "Well, of course she did."
Yes.
So I read, there were 2,000 pages. It took me 3 weeks to learn them, to read them, and I found these alarming things in there, and it gave me much more of a feeling. Many of the excerpts are embedded in Denial of Justice because they showed how Dorothy really had gotten herself in danger, because she sat there in the front row and she heard, you know, such testimony as, you know, Jack Ruby's in the Dallas Morning News office at exactly the time that JFK's being assassinated in Daley Plaza, and he's looking down the street toward there. "I will be there," is one other excerpt from a primary source witness, a parking lot manager. Ruby says, "I will be there on the telephone." when Oswald's going to be transferred, which is completely contradictory of what he said about the Western Union and all that. He also says, I made like a reporter to get into the Dallas Police Department basement, and all my friends at the Dallas Police Department helped me do that. And some of that's in some of Dorothy's columns and everything. And so, you know, again, she just directed me to those things, those transcripts, because you can't argue with that. You can argue with what I say or you say or other so-called experts or whatever, but these are primary witnesses who were there in Dallas when JFK died. And so, you know, I don't use the word conspiracy. I like plot to kill the president because I think it fits better, but you make a great point. That especially these days, what people do is kind of just lump, you know, people who are serious about research like you and me into this whole conspiracy type thing.
Right.
And it muddies the water.
That's the whole
but you
point.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the intention, for sure. That's right.
Well, and yeah, so, and it's very, very disturbing. Now, I would like to touch on a few other things before we go into your main theory. One of them is Alan Dulles. And I've read both books. I may have missed it. I haven't seen anything that you have in here about Dulles and his connection to all of this. But what
no,
is.
No, and let me just tell you, you won't. Again, I'm a Dorothy guy. And so Dorothy never mentioned anything like that in any of her columns or anything that I read. Basically, she saw this as the JFK assassination, to simplify it, as a mob hit. Here's what she believed happened. And I ascribe to this theory just because it makes common sense, and I'm a former criminal defense lawyer, so I always look at motive and common sense and all of that. But here's what she believed happened. Carlos Marcello's back is against the wall. If he kills Bobby Kennedy, JFK will come after him with everything the government has. So what does he do? He decides he's going to orchestrate the death of Jack Kennedy so Bobby Kennedy will be powerless. And I can tell you right now, that's what happened. Bobby Kennedy never went after those gangsters again until he finally resigned in September of 1967. So that was her belief, and that's what you can find sifting through her columns and all that. Well, now what do you do when Lee Harvey Oswald, who she believed was part of the plot to kill the president, is arrested? Well, you bring in somebody that can take care of that loose end. And, you know, Melvin Belli made a statement that I found through a colleague of his when he was told by a waiter that Lee Harvey Oswald had been killed. He said, well, now I'll have to represent Jack Ruby. Which, if true, and I believe it is, meant that Belli knew about the assassination before it happened, and that he was supposed to represent Ruby, and that he's brought in. And how does he defend Jack Ruby? Well, your listeners may know that what did he do? Number one, he wouldn't let Ruby testify. And number two, he came up with this ludicrous motor epilepsy insanity defense that made no sense. If you read the Ruby trial transcripts, the jury just turned their ears off to that because nobody can understand it. So basically, what do? Well, you shut up Ruby, and that shuts up the loose end that is there. And so basically, it's done. And Ruby and Dorothy really believed that that was what happened. It was based on motive. It was a mafia hit, and JFK basically was what I would call collateral damage, which I've named the next book. Because he wasn't even supposed to be the person who was killed, but basically that happened so that Bobby would be powerless. And we can take that one step further, if you don't mind, because what happened in 1968? Well, Bobby Kennedy was killed. Now, thus far, there really hasn't been a connection between Sirhan Sirhan and Marcello and all those gangsters, but if you look at common sense, what are those guys thinking? And I'm talking about Sam Giancana, Carlos Marcello, Traficante, all of those guys. They're saying to themselves, well, Bobby didn't come after us in 1963 when his brother was killed, but if he becomes president of the United States, what's the first thing he's going to do? Because Bobby Kennedy had told several of his associates, he thought it was Carlos Marcello who orchestrated the death of JFK, and Bobby Kennedy Jr., continues to give presentations where he confirms that's what Bobby thought. So it, you can go on into the killing of JFK, or of Bobby Kennedy in 1968, because they couldn't let him become president. And my bet is that down the line, someplace, somebody will connect Sirhan Sirhan with those same guys that orchestrated the death of JFK.
Yeah, I would think so. Now, who exactly is Marcello?
Well, we trace him back to New York, because Dorothy Kilgallen, at that time, you have to remember, gangsters were kind of celebrities.
Right.
Frank Costello and all of them. And Costello is the one who set up, he was a New York mobster. Dorothy knew him. He used to come to a weekly science game that they had at P.J. Clark's, which is a famous place in Manhattan.
And oh, yeah, I've been there many times. I know
too,
P.J.'s
and,
well.
And that's where Dorothy was on the last night of her life. That's that right there. So she knew Costello. At one point, he bought her a necklace and all of that, and so a diamond necklace. And so it was Costello who set up Marcello in New Orleans, and with the gaming industry and the slot machines and all of that. Well, he had about a $60 million empire there in 1963. And Bobby Kennedy hated those guys. If you look at the book, read the book, The Enemy Within, he made fun of them, their fancy clothes. At the McClellan hearings, he made fun of them. I mean, they were arch enemies of his. And when Joe Kennedy ordered ordered JFK to appoint Bobby Kennedy, and I have an eyewitness who was right there when it happened, a respected journalist, then Bobby went after those guys, and specifically Marcello. He deported him to Guatemala. Marcello got back in the country. He was starting to deport him again and charged him with racketeering. And in fact, on the very day that JFK was assassinated, Marcello was in a courtroom in New Orleans defending himself. So his empire then stretched to Dallas. Joe Campese and Joe were his underlings there. They were both involved with Jack Ruby's Carousel Club. And as a matter of fact, you talk about clues just jumping out in front of people and everybody missed it. The very first person to have visited Jack Ruby in jail was Joe Campese. And if anybody had been thinking at all about anything but this Oswald along theory, they would wonder why in the hell, first of all, is a known mobster being let into the county jail, and why is he visiting Ruby? But they missed all that. So though all the connections are there, and Marcello just, as I say, as Dorothy believed, remember, the first place she went was to New Orleans. She didn't stay in Dallas looking into JFK.
Right.
She didn't go to Washington with Alan Dulles or any of the CIA or anything. She just believed, based on her her knowledge of the underworld. I mean, you can't mess around with those guys. If you got a second, I'll tell you a personal story.
Sure, we've got more than a second. Go right ahead.
When I was a correspondent for Good Morning America and analyzing cases for them, for the networks, and I continued on with the networks with the, you know, O.J. and Tyson and Kobe Bryant cases. But my very first one was in that capacity was the show sent me to Philadelphia. And there was a mobster there who ran the city named Angelo Bruno. And at that time, the mafia was trying to get into Atlantic City. This is probably about 1978 or 9. And so apparently the lawyer for Bruno got in touch with the GMA people and said he would welcome an interview about Las Vegas or about Atlantic City. So the producer sent me over there, and I put on my nice little suit and went into his office and sat down with him. And he started telling me information that I didn't really think he should be sharing about Bruno, about Las Vegas, about Atlantic City, and this kind of thing. Well, I got done with the interview. Producers took it back to New York. They played it the next day. The hosts were Sandy Hill and David Hartman. And, I mean, everybody was amazed at what this guy had said. And so the producer called me. I hadn't left Philadelphia yet. And he called me and he said, listen, would you see if he'll talk to you again? And so I got on the phone and I called the office and this woman answered and I could tell she was a little hesitant. And I said, hey, this is Mark Shaw from Good Morning America. I was just there yesterday. I'd like to talk to whatever the lawyer's name was. I can't remember now. And she hesitated again. And then I could tell it that she was crying. And I said, are you okay? And she said, well, I guess you don't know. Mr. Lawyer was sitting in his car this morning, and when he started it, it blew up.
Oh,
you can't mess around with those guys.
No.
They have their own way of dealing with things. And I'll tell you what, I got out of that city as quickly as I could. He had obviously provided way too much information. You know, they always wanted to stay below the surface. The last thing they wanted was any publicity. And that guy paid for talking too much.
Free Dreamlanders, we're taking our final break. I hope you enjoy it and do everything that we suggest in these commercials. We'll be right back.
Did you know that the Unknown Country newsletter is absolutely free and comes to you by email once a week? The newsletter has been published since 2000, and in all that time, not one subscriber has ever received a single piece of spam, because they were on our list. But what they have received, week in and week out, is the very latest from unknowncountry.com, including a Dreamland preview and all the latest news. Go to unknowncountry.com and sign up today. You owe it to yourself, and it's free.
Listen to some words from one of our longtime subscribers.
As a subscriber of Dreamland for many years, it's been an incredible adventure and truly a Rosetta Stone for so many of the experiences that all of your listeners have had. Please join us. It's a fantastic ride. But I will say that certainly Dreamland does reflect something that I've always known, that man's mind mirrors a universe that mirrors man's mind. And no other place will you get this truth than on Dreamland. Come join us.
Not too many shows get endorsements like that from people who have been with us for years. Join us. Join the fun. Join the adventure. Join the exploration. $4.95 a month, $39.50 a year, 6 month and 3 month subscriptions too. Go to unknowncountry.com, click on the subscribe tab on the upper right, and get aboard. You will not be sorry. It's a great experience to be part of this community. We're talking to Mark Shaw about Dorothy Kilgallen. He's written two books about her. He's written The Reporter Who Knew Too Much and Denial of Justice. She was certainly a very major figure in the whole issue of what happened to JFK, and died probably because of her knowledge. Mark's website is markshawbooks.com, and you can get all of his stuff there, and you can contact Mark very easily on his website. So if the reason that Dorothy ended up bringing Mark to this show is because someone with valuable information for Mark is going to hear it, and we both feel that this happened because of Dorothy, as we discussed earlier, don't hesitate to write Mark. He will respond, and quickly, you can be sure. Okay, let's now track back a little bit and talk about Dorothy herself and her life. I purposely watched the last show just this week.
What's
My Line that she was on. And I also watched the next one when they are talking about her.
Mm-hmm.
And I watched also the show afterwards where the panel are talking about Dorothy and her death. And in particular, I watched Bennett Cerf.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you've done the same. And do you have any impression of his demeanor that goes beyond just his sadness?
Yeah, I felt like that. Of course he's going to be the publisher of that book that she had, and I think Bennett Cerf was if you read a lot about him, there's a lot of criticism and everything, but he was a historian like you and me, a historian, and I think he felt like that he had his hands on one of the most important books of the 20th century, if not of all time, because whatever he read that night before, or that show before, the night before the last show of hers, I think he felt like that, my gosh, what Dorothy knew about this is going to, you know, it's just going to, you know, it's just going to amaze people. And we're going to have the most credible account of what happened to JFK and all of this. And so I had a feeling that it was a feeling of remorse for sure that you know, and he felt terrible about her dying, but also the fact that he wanted to get a hold of that whole manuscript. I know that he tried to do so afterwards, but there's a lot of conjecture as to exactly what happened to her file that had some of those papers in it. So, yeah, I saw some of that in his face. Did you feel the same way?
Oh, yeah. That's why I brought it up. Now, when you talk about her files, what did happen immediately after, on the day her death was reported to the police?
Yeah, yeah. Well, so we're getting toward November 8th of 1965, and, you know, Dorothy is straight ahead in terms of the book, and she's a lot of people like to say that she was having a tough time, but her career was at its peak. She had the radio show. She had, you know, the column. She had the What's My Line? 25 million people watching that show every Sunday, for God's sakes. I mean, she was the biggest celebrity. New York Post called her the most powerful female voice in America. This is a college dropout whose career just skyrocketed. And so, anyway, she's on top of her game and everything. And so she kept with her this file, and it had gotten thicker as time had gone along, we believe, and I think it's appropriate to do so, that her notes of her Jack Ruby trial interview were there, some of the manuscript, other things that she learned when she went to New Orleans, all of that is in that file. Well, people have said, well, why in the world didn't she make a copy of it? Well, you couldn't go down to Kinko's and do that. There would have only been a carbon. There were copy machines, but they were in its infancy. So basically, this was it. And she carried it around with her everywhere, which she should not have done, but she did, and she took it to that show. So we skip to the show is over. She goes to the Regency Hotel. She's seen with a mystery man there, which I have proven to be this Ron Pataki, a journalist who I've also now proven in the new book was basically a Judas. He was letting other people know what she had written in that file and what she was going to write in the book, which led to her death. And so she met with him, and then we know she left the Regency Hotel. She went home, either with him or, you know, he came to the apartment, the townhouse after that. One way or another, we don't know exactly what happened, but through forensics, I've been able to show that she did not die of an accidental overdose combined with alcohol. Of course, the ME verdict was circumstances undetermined. They really didn't know exactly what had happened to her. But I've proven through a forensic test, both at that time and 3 years later, that she was murdered, that she did not commit suicide, and she didn't accidentally death. So her body is found at 9 o'clock the next morning by the hairdresser who comes over to fix her hair for a meeting she has at Carrie's school.
Her son.
Her son, yes, the boy that went to the White House. And so she's found then in a bedroom. We believe her husband took her from the bathroom into the bedroom she never slept in. She's wearing clothes she never wore to bed, has on a hairpiece, has on her makeup and her false eyelashes that she never wore to bed. It doesn't take a smart man to realize it's a staged death scene, but when the police come, they see an empty bottle of Seconal pills. And later I would show that she had not only Seconal, but Tylenol and phenobarbital in her system. Basically, they see the Seconal bottle and they decide, hey, here's another celebrity who overdosed. So it takes about 3 hours for the police to get there. In the meantime, I've proven that FBI agents came to that townhouse and took away all of her documents, her papers, her files, everything. So that file is, if that is true, still alive today in the FBI files or the New York Police Department files or someplace. I've been attempting to get that file by requesting investigations by the New York District Attorney and now the New York Police Department Commissioner that I met with in February. If that isn't true and the file wasn't taken by these people, then Richard, her husband, said that he found it. And then it disappeared after that and has not been found to this day. And so one of my quests in life, and Dorothy keeps, advising me, I will say, to keep after it. So based on that, I believe it is still out there. And my latest venture into getting the New York Police Department, Dermot Shea, to have his cold case squad investigate her death. I also filed recently a Freedom of Information request, and one of the things I asked for was that file, and if it's the last thing I do, I'm going to find that file.
Well, I sure hope you do, because it would be a major, major discovery for sure. Now, let's run back a little bit into this whole mafia issue and Joe Kennedy, who plays a big role in this because of his mafia connections. Can you tell us a little bit about who he actually was? And, of course, everyone believes, and probably correctly, that F. Scott Fitzgerald's model for the Great Gatsby was Joe Kennedy. What was he? Where did the Kennedys come from?
Well, what's interesting is they came from Boston, the Boston area, and I actually found a gentleman recently who got in touch with me because of listening to a radio show just like yours, or a podcast, who told me a lot about the Kennedys at the time. They weren't well liked. They were pushy. He gave me an example of them going into a restaurant and having dinner and then just walking away without paying. Joe Kennedy was extremely wealthy. He had made his money kind of some from good investments, some from an illicit way. There were, I think, substantial confirmations of the fact that he was involved in bootlegging at one point, and that's where he got his connections with the mafia. But Joe wanted to be president of the United States, and he had the power and he had the money. He became ambassador to the United Kingdom, and while he was over there, unfortunately, Joe kind of never objected to what Adolf Hitler was doing, kind of appeased Hitler and all that. That got around. His reputation was tarnished. He came back to the United States, and his chances of being president were none. And so he said to himself, well, if I can't be president, then one of my sons will be. And in fact, they all will be. And I think it's been proven because he said at the time, first Joe Jr. is going to be president, then JFK, then Bobby Kennedy, and then Ted Kennedy. Now, it's hard to believe that anybody could think that way, but that's what he thought. Using his power and money, he could do it. Well, Joe Jr. got killed in the war, so JFK is up next. And what really concerns me is that then we get to, JFK running for president, substantial confirmations, again, through primary sources that they were going to lose West Virginia and Illinois. So Joe uses Frank Sinatra, a friend of the Kennedy family, and he gets in touch with Sam Giancana and Marcello and Trafficante, and they all tell him that, they can help Joe, but Joe needs to be able to take Bobby and get him off their back with regard to what may happen if JFK becomes president. So they help, and JFK wins those states, and JFK's in the White House. And as I say, I have a primary witness who was right there when JFK ordered, Joe Kennedy ordered JFK to appoint Bobby Attorney General. What really concerns me about these kinds of things are distortions of history. And I will point to two. One is the JFK Library. While working on this new book, I started to go in there and look at some of the material they have, and they just whitewash the whole 1960 election. They don't mention anything that would tarnish the fact that JFK became president. They don't talk about Joe Kennedy's dark side and his womanizing and all the things that went on. He just brush all over that. The other is the Sixth Floor Museum at Daley Plaza. And regarding, they don't have anything in there about Dorothy Kilgallen or the Ruby trial transcripts. I have a personal experience with them about that. It's the last thing I ever do besides finding Dorothy's file. It will be to close that museum because all the distortions of history are there. It's all about Oswald alone and nothing else. And so these distortions of history drive me crazy because, we need to know exactly how it happened. Now, many of your listeners are saying, hey, why do we care about the JFK assassination so many years later? Well, this is one of the most important events in history, and it is about history. And we don't want young people, for instance, walking into that Daley Plaza museum or into the JFK library and being hoodwinked or basically, there's deception there in terms of distortions of history.
It was a fundamental change in the way our world works. It was the most important, one of the most important assassinations in history. I mean, I don't think there's a more important one except maybe Julius Caesar.
And it may very well be.
And yeah. you just have to look at what happened to the presidency and where it has gone since then. It is a different institution in many, many ways, much, much less and much more.
Why do you think so? Why do you think so? May I ask?
Yeah, I think that that when JFK left us, mm-hmm. Lyndon Johnson, who was very involved with my family, his wife and one of my aunts were very close friends, and became president. And before that, I never talk about these things until they're out. Robert Caro, in his new book about Lyndon Johnson, mentions and talks about the fact that Lyndon was in a lot of trouble with because of an involvement in the crimes of a man named Billy Saul Estes.
I remember that, yeah.
A typical Texas crime. He was a con man who had a lot of empty big storage spaces that were full of soy oil or something, and they were actually completely empty. And Lyndon stood a good chance of going to jail, and he was probably going to be thrown off the ticket for this because of this. Mm-hmm. And you know, and also I know about the things that were done in Texas as well to make sure that Texas went for JFK, and that those mm-hmm. were done by Lyndon. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he felt he was owed as well.
Sure, sure.
And yet was very vulnerable because he thought that RFK was going to indict him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, could have very well happened, that's for sure.
Yeah, there's just – and now
– Bobby wanted to make a name for – excuse me, but Bobby wanted to make a name for himself. You know, he wanted to be president after JFK, and so – And we maybe next time when we talk, when the new book comes out in April, we can get into the whole Bobby factor with regard to the Marilyn Monroe death, because Bobby had become arguably the second most powerful man in America. And I have no doubt, I hadn't thought about this before, and I thank you for it. You're right. Bobby Kennedy would have gone after JFK. He didn't want him on the ticket to begin with.
No, he would have gone after him, all right.
Yeah.
And Lyndon knew it. Lyndon definitely knew it, and... Now, I was personally involved with Senator Ralph Yarborough, who was a family friend. And when I was a boy, young 13-year-old boy, he took me up to Washington, I went up to Washington and met with him and spent a couple of days with him, having an absolutely wonderful time.
Wonderful, great.
Yeah, but he was sure that Lyndon was going to go to jail. And then suddenly the assassination comes, and that all just disappears, and Lyndon ends up in the White
motive
House.
There, that's for sure.
Yeah, yeah, instead.
Yeah, yeah.
And then after he got elected, he went on, after the assassination and the interim period, but after he won the election, he went around to a number of people, including some uncles of mine, to remind them that even though he was now in Washington as president of the United States, he had forgotten nothing. Mm. So it was pretty intense. Now,
well, you might wonder why Dorothy never looked into Lyndon Johnson, and I looked into that because you talk about money.
Oh, wonderful! Tell us that. That's great.
He became president of the United States. So, but Dorothy, she looked into that at one point. But there was, he was a very smart man. There's so many layers between anybody that they thought who could have actually carried out the JFK assassination and LBJ that she couldn't believe in her own mind that any investigation was going to get back to his culpability. Whereas there weren't any of those kinds of layers when you just looked at Carlos Marcello. I mean, Bobby had basically thrown him out of the country. And then was trying to put him in prison. And so you've got to get rid of this guy. And so the way you get rid of him is to kill JFK. So Bobby Kennedy is powerless. And Bobby just never went after those guys again. So I think that was the difference there. I think JFK was very smart. The politician in him, see, would have been would have given him kind of the, the experience of putting people between you and anything that happened that was dishonest. Although what you're telling me is that you believe there was sufficient evidence that he probably could have been indicted, correct?
Well, I think so. I think it's fairly clear from Robert Caro's new book that's the case, that he was implicated in this scandal deeply enough. And, you know, it's interesting. His wife was a much better business person than he was, and she wasn't involved in that. And how he got involved, God only knows. But Billy Saul Estes was an expert at palling around with politicians and so forth. He's he's not the only shyster who has run after the people in power in order to hide behind their skirts. And that's sort of what Billy Saul Estes was doing.
Sure.
Now,
we're
coming to the end of the first hour. We're going to do another half hour, and I want to get very deeply in this next half hour into the mafia connections and how they worked, and above all, what the mafia felt it had lost. And we're going to go back to the end of the Eisenhower administration and the failure of the Cuban of the attempt to invade Cuba, and then we're going to go into what the mafia's motive would have been, and are there any more motives, any more layers to this beyond the mafia? Because there were a lot of people that JFK was really disturbing, and I've just mentioned one: Lyndon Johnson. Alan Dulles is another. And Alan Dulles, after all, was running the CIA from his backyard by telephone. He wasn't even allowed in the building at that point, but because JFK wanted him out. So you got a lot of – and then who ends up on the Warren Commission but Alan Dulles?
And let's not forget to talk about J. Edgar Hoover, okay?
And Hoover. We must not forget to talk about Hoover.
You just brought up something there that I think you'll find interesting.
You know, well, I'll tell you something interesting about Hoover, folks. My dad said to me, this is long ago, this is many years ago, when Lyndon was still, I believe, still a senator, he said, you know, this man Hoover, he dances around in ladies' underwear. And if Dad knew it, then it had to be that he'd heard it from someone who knew Lyndon.
Oh, absolutely.
Which meant that Lyndon had his thumb on Hoover.
Oh, yes. They all did. They were all scared. He had so much dirt on them, I think he could have filled 25 large safes with that material. You bet.
Okay, Free Dreamlanders, thank you very much for being with us as always. And I urge you, subscribe to unknowncountry.com. Go to Mark's website, markshawbooks.com, and get involved. We've been talking about the reporter who knew too much and denial of justice, but there is not a book on there that you shouldn't read. The book about Melvin Belli is absolute dynamite. If you want to know what this world is, you have to understand where it came from. And the world we live in right now is in terrible trouble for a lot of reasons politically, because it was destabilized in fundamental ways when JFK died. Okay, Free Dreamlanders, we'll talk to you next week. Subscribers will keep on keeping on.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by unknowncountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.